So tonight's the last of the our practice period, the last evening of our practice period together on the five mindfulness trainings, and I hope you all have profited from this six-week period of practicing and studying together and investigating and reflecting upon your own lives and the meaning of the precepts of what it means to live an ethical life. Recently, a student said to me that in his divorce had violated one of these, made a mistake with one of these trainings. And he said he had never seen the precepts before. But in his heart, he knew, he was doing something wrong. And, truly, they do reflect something we already know inside of ourselves. We already know. It's not like someone has to tell us that to kill is damaging. They already live really inside of us. I mean, it's something about being human. Something true about our spiritual nature as human beings, and we know it already inside of ourselves. There is a poem that is read in Zen circles called, written by a 17th century Zen master in Japan, Hakuin. And it's called Song of Zazen. Zazen sometimes can be loosely translated as meditation. And it starts out, all beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. And that means you. That means me. All beings by nature are Buddha. And, somewhere where we know that already, somewhere inside of us we already know that there is a deep spiritual nature to our existence. I think anyone who practices touches it. And it's from that knowing, that deep knowing, that the mindfulness trainings arise. It's not like it's something outside of ourselves that we have to impose upon ourselves to keep us in line. It's like we already, know it inside of ourselves. It's already a deep truth as that we can examine. And, really, taking up the practice of the five mindfulness trainings is taking up that practice of acknowledging that that we too are the Buddha. We too have an awakened nature that is inherent to who we are, that is inherent to our existence. In fact, it's more inherent to who we are than our story and our self-identification as me and you. It's more profoundly true about our existence. Shakyamuni Buddha, when he saw the Venus star rise in the east, said, now, when I view all beings everywhere, I see that each of them possesses the wisdom and the virtue of the Tathagata, of the Buddha mind. But because of their attachments and their delusions, they cannot bear witness to that fact. And so, our practice is very much about, shedding those attachments and delusions. And as we take up the fifth mindfulness training, we find, well, that's really what this one is about, this precept is about. Originally, when the Buddha taught this as a precept, he spoke about the most insidious and dangerous of attachments, which are physical addictions, drugs and alcohol. And that's where this started as a precept, because drugs and alcohol are such a powerful physical attachment that we can't necessarily just even break with our mind. It's a place of getting totally lost. And you know, it's important to see, you know, like when Thay first taught this as a mindfulness training or as a precept, he said, you know, he didn't say this means don't drink any alcohol, although later he did say that. And and this is sort of the one mindfulness training, the one that he became pretty specific about, you don't do this. And the others are guidelines, are like fingers pointing to the North Star, knowing that we'll never get there. For example, we know it's not possible to live without some form of killing. You know, we breathe, we drink water, we eat carrots. But this one can be a little more absolute, and it's because of the inherent danger of drinking alcohol. And it's really easy to think that, oh well, you know, it's not something that's a danger for me because I can have a glass of wine and it's not a problem in my life. You know, Friday nights I like to have a glass of wine with the person I love the best, and it's really a lovely way to end the week. But he saw, and as I've seen, is that that I don't think I've yet met a person who hasn't been affected by alcohol in some way or another, or someone they love has not been affected in the sense of addiction. And it's really, you know, important to look at our own lives in that light, I think. To see where that, you know, our lives have been affected by somebody who's been addicted to alcohol. And not dismiss it, you know. I mean, it's like when we take this precept, it's really to be in solidarity with everyone in the world, you know, and it's vast numbers of people that are addicted. I have this horrible affliction. And the same with drugs, and we can see, you know, all along the border with Mexico, I mean, this horrible thing that is happening because of addiction to drugs, and it's the addiction that exists within our culture that is largely responsible for the drug cartels and the war, the vast number of people who are dying because of the drug cartels in Mexico. We had two very wonderful people who spent 6 months last year at Mountain Lamp, who will likely be coming back to live, Carlos and Guadalupe, and they come from a quite large city, kind of in the middle of Mexico in the desert, called Torreon. Very few people have heard of because it's not a place of destination. But Guadalupe said, you know, everybody in that town is afraid. I mean, it's over 1 million people live there, and everyone is afraid because of the random violence and killings that are happening because of the drug cartels. And, you know, that's the danger that this original, the Buddha originally taught this precept is pointing to, you know, how a physical addiction really can make us kind of crazy. Crazy in the sense of we're no longer in touch with any level of our spirituality, any level of the suffering, any responsibility towards suffering in the world. This mindfulness training is really interesting in the sense that the other ones have all been kind of about our thoughts and actions in the world. You know, it's like the energy we put out. And, you know, thought is energy, action is energy, material goods are energy, money is good energy. If we look at it all as energy, the other mindfulness trainings are all about, you know, what we put out. And this mindfulness training is very much about the energy we take in and what it does to us. Because our world is so very different from the Buddha's when this precept was originally taught, you know, the words that are used in the mindfulness training are much more encompassing than just the physical addictions around drugs and alcohol. It also talks about gambling, which is an addiction, psychological. It also talks about computer games, which, you know, there's research now that's showing that people actually get addicted to both pornography on the internet and especially young kids to the games that are played on the internet. And, you know, it's really easy to think, well, this is, you know, I don't take those kind of energies into my body, and it is good to be aware of, you know, of that. But what this really points most directly to is for us to really look at the energy we are taking in to our bodies all the time. And how that affects us. A long time ago, I used to smoke cigarettes, and I was never a very heavy smoker, but I smoked cigarettes. And that's another one of those physical addictions. Yeah, it's really hard to quit, and I found that it was really possible to use mindfulness as a way to stop. And it was to really pay close attention to when I wanted a cigarette, and you know, honor the craving and pay really close attention to lighting up and to inhaling and how it felt. And how I felt emotionally and physically, and after the cigarette was done, how I felt, and 5 minutes later, after I'd smoked a cigarette, how it felt. And just by paying really close attention, you know, to all the sort of aspects, how I felt 24 hours later, was enough to make it really easy just to stop. And there was really no willpower involved at all. Interestingly enough, it was simply like by paying really good attention and not being in denial about any of it, about the desire to smoke or the smoking itself, but to be really present with it. You know, I noticed, you know, the momentary feeling kind of getting energized. I noticed the letdown afterwards. I noticed the scratchy throat 24 hours later. I didn't want to smoke anymore. I just didn't want to do it. And, you know, for any of these particular things that we feel are possibly an energy that we're taking into our bodies that doesn't increase our well-being, doesn't take good care of us, we can practice that same kind of mindfulness. So, if it's a TV show, all the things that are listed, books, conversations, gossip. I mean, it's really, really good to be aware of that. You know, when we hear somebody criticizing somebody else, and even though it might not be our experience of that person, somehow it affects what we think about that person, and it creates separation. It's damaging. So this particular mindfulness training really is about being mindful in our lives and paying attention. You know, Tayo says Buddha is mindfulness. And, you know, really and truly in terms of our practice, it's not about, you know, saying, oh, getting caught in all our struggle and all our negativity. Recognizing it when it's there. Because, you know, indeed, truly, none of us can deny that life is messy. It just is. It was messy when we were born. It's messy when we go out. There's all sorts of feelings. In the sense of, you know, this individual, separate self, separate body, there's a lot of pain and suffering and heartache. And on one hand, you know, these mindfulness trainings are just about, you know, looking at our life and seeing where we are getting caught in ways that create that messiness of life. But there's something else that's even more important, I think, about the mindfulness trainings than the mess, than the difficulty, than the struggle, than the how can I ever live this? And that is that, you know, we look at these with the eyes of the Buddha. You know, we look at these from the heart of mindfulness. And, you know, what is that? This particular mindfulness training, I think, points to it really, really directly. It's that we are indeed all interconnected. Everything is interconnected. Everything is the mind of the Buddha. The term sin comes from the word separation. And when we feel separate, is when they're suffering. That's the delusion that the Buddha talked about. Is this sense that somehow you're different than me, and because of that, you know, if I think badly of you, well, you know, you do things different than me, you know, so I don't know if I like you so much, or whatever, you know. That sense of separation. Is the foundation of suffering and how we create suffering, how suffering continues to be perpetuated. And when we see truly with the eyes of the Buddha, we see that from the very beginning we've never been separate. And there are both things are true here. That on one hand, indeed, our bodies, my body is here, your body is there, and that in that world of form there is separation. But in the deep spiritual reality of our existence, there is none at all. There never has been. What is most true about you is the same as what's most true about me, is the same as what's most true about grasses, bushes, bears, salmon. We all are interconnected. The air, the water, the mountains. It's all one. And those two realities are like, you know, we can see the front of our hand and we say, ah, this is the front of my hand. And we can see the back of our hand and we say, oh, this is the back of my hand. And they're different. But they're not. They're the same. It's the same hand. And this particular mindfulness training helps us to see and to hold both of those realities as true. That what we do affects everything else. It's like a spider web. If you touch just one place in the spider web, everything else moves. Everything else in the whole web is affected. And what is really particularly beautiful about this particular mindfulness training is that it tells us to be aware of violence, anger, as it arises, judgment, as it arises within us, so that we can take really good care of ourselves. And it's not that we take really good care of ourselves just for ourselves. We take really good care of ourselves for the sake of each other and for the sake of the whole world. In the Abhidharma, which is the text on Buddhist psychology that came from the Sarvastivadin school of Buddhism in northern India, it says, mind is a field. And within that field are the seeds of everything. We can understand that within the field of our spiritual connection, the Buddha mind, are the seeds of everything. And we can touch whatever seeds, and when we touch whatever seeds we touch, the whole field is affected. The whole mind everywhere is affected. And, you know, it's hard to see that from this place of a separate self. It's like, ah, what I do, you know, what difference does it make? You know, it doesn't, I can do whatever I want. And certainly, you know, there is, you know, in the West, particularly, we're raised to know that and as, you know, independent individuals. And there's nothing wrong with that, because we do have to honor ourselves. And at the same time, we need to take complete responsibility for our actions as they affect the whole. And this mindfulness training keeps pointing us to doing that. And the interesting thing about it is, in paying attention in this way, it's not about restricting ourselves. It's not about holding ourselves back. It's not about beating ourselves up or saying we're not good enough. But it is about transforming the separation, the sin, that is in our life, so that we can know the whole reality of the Buddha mind, the whole spiritual reality, we can call it God, that we are completely immersed in. That is our very bones and marrow and breath. And that in the most true understanding, we can never be separate from. So this precept calls us to be our very best self, to touch the very best that is part of who we are, and to touch it and invite it in those around us. There's a tendency, I think, in Buddhism for people to think that compassion means that we connect with people in their woundedness, in their brokenness. And, you know, really what compassion truly is to connect with people in their wholeness, in the best parts of who they are. We have a tendency to think that by connecting with people in their woundedness, that's some sort of empathy. But in fact, often it just supports people in their woundedness. It just supports people in perpetuating their brokenness. You know, we see the Buddha in each other, and we reach out to the Buddha in each other, and we support the Buddha in each other. And that is really, truly the nourishment and healing that this fifth mindfulness training is talking about. We touch the healing qualities in our own lives and in each other, and support that, and support each other in that way, and in that way support the world. And the thing that is most true about that is it seems like it's something we're doing and we're creating and we're making. But in fact, we are completely supported by the vast truth of reality, by the Buddha mind, because we are part of that. So it's not so much that we have to do this or that we're alone in this. Truly, as we began this practice period together, looking at refuge, at the contemplation of refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, taking refuge in the Buddha, our own awakened nature, our own goodness and light, calling that forth in each other as well. Taking refuge in the Dharma, the unfolding truth, the ever-arising truth. They're never static. Truth. And in the Sangha, in truly what is best about each and every one of us. Taking refuge there, we find that we are profoundly supported. That we aren't indeed alone doing this, but that the whole nature of the universe, the whole web of interconnectedness, is supporting us. And so it's not such a chore. We're part of it all, and we're supported by it all. And that is the truth of the Buddha mind. So truly in practicing mindfulness, it is important, and more than important, it is wonderful to remember Haku and Zenji's words, is all beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water, and live together in that awareness and bring forth that awareness in the world for the sake of all beings. So, you know, I apologize, missed last Monday. I was getting sick and I really felt I needed to be home, and it was the right thing to do. But tonight was supposed to be a time for question and answers, and so I wanted to leave time to address any questions that might have come up in this practice period together, and or any questions that you might have. So the question is, what is emptiness? And I gave a talk on this this weekend at Dharma Friendship Foundation as part of a conference on the Heart Sutra. Very nice gathering. I enjoyed it very much. Again, referring to Hakuin, he wrote a book about the Heart Sutra, and it's available in English, and the translation in English of the title is Zen Words for the Heart. But the real character in Japanese for the title is Poison Words for the Heart. And it's poison words for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's because words are concepts, and we try to make them into something. And concepts if we're caught in concepts, if we're attached to concepts, they obscure reality. Because if we're, you know, and we all know this from our practice of mindfulness, if we're caught in our thinking minds, we're not experiencing what's right here. You know, so concepts can be helpful in that they point towards something, but they also can be poison because they keep us from really experiencing what's here right now. And that's what our practice is about. It's about paying attention and experiencing this moment, in this moment. So I take up the word emptiness with that caveat that it is not a concept, and if you try to understand it as a concept, you will not ever have the opportunity of experiencing it. Tai takes up the, you know, emptiness, speaks about emptiness as, he says, it's empty of what? And that it's important to look at everything, to see that when we talk about emptiness, nothing is truly empty. You know, if you take a glass of water, and you drink all the water, and you think, now it's empty. But actually, you know, in terms of the glass itself, it has water. It's full of air. It has no water, but now it's full of air. But even more intimately with this glass, you can see that there's sand here. There's fire. Because glass is made out of sand and fire. And probably for there to be fire, there's petroleum. And as soon as we get into petroleum, we get deep into the earth and deep into time, because billions of years ago, petroleum comes from the lives of animals and plants that have been compressed under the earth for a long time. So immediately when we look at this glass and we look at it in this way, we see that we have entered into a space beyond, entered into something beyond space and time. Because what this glass is filled with is beyond space and time. We can also see the factory where the glass was made, the air that fed the fire, the workers that made the mold, the truckers that brought it to us. And you can see that everything, and this is what the Buddha said, everything is contained in one thing. Everything is contained in, and all is contained in one thing. One thing contains the many contains the one thing. And this begins to help us approach what emptiness is. Yamada Roshi, my grandfather in the Diamond Sangha tradition, called it empty oneness. And, you know, that it is symbolized in calligraphy by a circle that, and we can see that circle as empty and not having anything in it, or it can be a circle as well that contains all things. Another metaphor, and that's the best we can do, and it's always just a metaphor. Again, that's very commonly used in our tradition is the metaphor of waves and water, that each individual wave is separate, and yet it's made up of water. And the true nature is water of all waves. And if we just identify with the wave, that's identifying with form. But if we know there is also something greater that holds us all, that is our true nature, then we begin to look more deeply and we see that everything also has the same innate, inherent nature, the nature of water. And that no separate wave can ever be apart from the water, can be understood. And the water is always changing, just as the waves are always changing. Always changing. And so there's nothing to hold on to, and we can only touch it in this moment. We can only know what is beyond space and time in this moment. And that's why we practice mindfulness. Being right here, right now. We can't touch it in the past, we can't touch it in the future. It always is changing with form. And it is the infinite, boundless, spacious potential from which all things arise, from which you and I have arisen, and at the same time are never separate from. And we can come to know this through our practice of mindfulness, concentration, and virtue. Which is what we've been engaging with over the last 6 weeks. So, it's, you know, important not to seek after emptiness as an idea or as a concept. And there's a second reason why Hakuin's book is called Poison Words of the Heart, for the Heart. And that is because if we truly realize what emptiness means, when the Heart Sutra says form is emptiness, emptiness is form, you know, the is too much. Form, emptiness, exactly the same. If we truly realize that, then we lose our lives. And that's the other meaning of the poison, is that great gift by which self and other fall away, birth and death fall away, you and me fall away, and we realize the nature of water, the nature of the Buddha mind. And so that poison is the greatest gift, the treasure jewel in the midst of the lotus flower.
Are you saying, and I don't believe you are, but I'm going to ask this question anyway, should not care for broken people?
No, I didn't say that. I said don't be attached to people and their brokenness.
So if someone is hungry, their brokenness is their hunger, is it not?
No. If somebody's broken, we give them food. Don't get caught in ideas. It's not being broken to be hungry.
So if someone is emotionally broken, then how would you approach that?
How would I approach it? Well, it really depends on the individual and what the situation is, of course. But it's not to support people in being broken. You know, we can recognize people's brokenness. We can love them in spite of it. But we don't support them in that. We don't support a killer going around shooting people. We don't support people in their meanness. We don't support people in their greediness. Yeah.
There's something there that concerns me. I'm not sure exactly how to approach it. There's a kind of coolness that concerns me. I feel that.
You know, when we're practicing, you know, the first place where we really touch pain is usually, I mean, hopefully, it's in our own hearts, in our own lives. And in practicing with that, and it's really important we do practice with it. But if we identify with that pain, we'll get lost in it, and we'll get overwhelmed by it, and we'll be swept away by it. On the same token, if we push it away, deny it, cover it over, again, this is very much the fifth mindfulness training. Usually the ways we do that is through consumption of distraction. And so, you know, our practice very much is recognizing the pain, seeing the pain for what it is, and then sitting as the Buddha and holding it. But that doesn't mean saying, I know this is true. You know, it's like looking with the eyes of the Buddha at it and holding it till it transforms. And that's very much when we are able to do that and we have a little bit of transformation in our own suffering. You know, there's a little bit of light there. And we know how to respond then to the world. So for example, you know, if we've been able to sit in our own anger, in the fire of our own anger, without getting caught up in the story and believing the story and knowing we have every reason to be pissed off at that person and man, we're going to go after them. You know, not doing any of that. Just sitting there, feeling it, and coming back to our breath, and smiling with the smile of the Buddha, with the composure of the Buddha, with the equanimity and the non-attachment to that anger. Eventually, we see through it, and we see what's beneath it. We understand where it came from. And we know exactly how to be with it, to heal it. And when we've been able to sit like that within our own suffering, then when we see it in other people, we know how to do the same thing without getting caught up in supporting, buying into, fueling the anger. We know how to look at it with calm eyes, with the mind of the Buddha. Without being afraid, without pushing it away. And it's in that that there's the healing. Pema Chodron talks about idiot compassion.
Idiot compassion.
And idiot compassion is that when we hear about somebody's suffering and we buy into it as reality, the only reality. Okay? It's like when I'm talking about right hand, front and back, the same. That people are caught in their identification to the story of their suffering, and they're spreading it around, often in a way that, and it, when we're spreading around our suffering, you know we're creating suffering elsewhere, right? Yeah. So it's true compassion is to see it for what it is, and not to support somebody in spreading it around. And that's what the mindfulness trainings say, every single one of them. Mm. And that doesn't mean we aren't compassionate. It means we're not lost in compassion in a way that hurts us and hurts the person that's suffering and hurts the world. And so it's really, and it's a really excellent question, Jack. I think it's really valuable to spend some time really thinking about it and reflecting upon it, really in light of what we've done over the last 6 weeks.
Yeah. I understand, but I'm still... I understand what you're saying. And I get that you don't want to enable somebody, which is what it's called in some circles. At the same time, to me, compassion also... involves clarity and kindness in that clarity. Mm. And that's important to me, that there be kindness in that clarity, and that it be distinct and carefully placed or stated. You know what I'm saying?
If you have an idea of what kindness is, and you and you're acting out of an idea rather than out of a kind heart, you know, then there's some denial happening, I believe. I want to say there are times when it's really important to be very strict, and it's not necessarily out of a lack of kindness. You know, with a child who's going to do something to hurt themselves, it's really important right away to say, stop! Don't do that. In such a way that they hear you. And I know you've experienced that and know that from your own lives, and certainly all of us as parents know that. And it might sound very strong, you know, but it is out of our love and our compassion that we step forth in that way. And so that's not denying compassion or kindness, but it's being responding to the situation in the way it needs to be responded to. And so that's appropriate action. And that's very much what the five mindfulness trainings are pointing us towards, is appropriate responding to a situation.
I understand.
I think we've run out of time, but I think, you know, these are really excellent questions because they do point us to really thinking about and really looking into our own hearts and lives. And that, boy, if anything I wanted out of this practice period, is that's what I really wanted, is for us to be questioning. You know, really reflecting upon what this means and really looking at our own lives, you know, and what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, so to have these be a place for questioning and reflecting and not just a bunch of words that we you know, sort of take for granted as, you know, this is what it means or this is what it means. But really looking deeply inside and in our actions in the world. And most importantly, to know that these arise from the awakened mind, from the mind of compassion. And that is available to us. That is who we are innately. They are a true expression of our human nature. So thank you very much. Thank you for practicing.
To stretch our legs a little bit and get them moved out. And while we're doing the stretching, we'll turn it into a time for announcements. So if you have announcements, this is good.